magic,
and the world of illusion.
Magic TV
and Craig Petty proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig. It's 9 o'clock, which means it's time for a Talk Magic. And I'm here today with my favorite double act in magic. These are two guys that have absolutely taken the world by storm. They are super entertaining and super amazing. And I love them to bits. I am, of course, talking about Morgan and West, Rhys Morgan and Robert West. How are you doing, guys?
Hello. That was very kind and the most thoroughly embarrassing introduction I've ever had. So thank you for that.
And we'll be texting Young and Strange immediately.
Exactly.
I interviewed Richard Young on the channel, and Young and Strange are amazing, but you know, I'm kind of a Morgan and West fanboy. So are we.
We're big fans of Young and Strange. We're more Morgan and West fans.
I would say the biggest Morgan and West fans.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Imagine that you would be, to be honest. But thanks so much for finding time to come on the channel. I know you guys are amazing. We'll talk about this later on. You've just started touring again. You're out performing, which is amazing. So I know that you've got lots of new shows that you're putting together, and you're kind of getting all that ready. So thank you for finding the time to actually do this. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. In fact, the stuff behind us is all costumes for the show that we're touring. Rather than just sort of conspicuous British flags placed everywhere. That's one of the characters' costumes. That's the Duke of Buckingham, rather than some sort of slightly odd placement in the background. Which I've only just realised. That's right there.
These are show costumes.
Well, I want to talk about that show later on, because you mentioned to me just off camera that there's not even any magic in this show.
No, a
big deviation from what people know you for, really.
In a way, it's us coming full circle. It's us back to our roots of how we met, because we didn't really do any magic until we'd been sort of working together on shows in university for like 2 years.
Yeah, a couple of years.
A little while. So it is a bit full circle for us.
Well, let's go back. Let's talk about the origin story and how Morgan and West came to be.
So we were bitten by a radioactive Victorian.
Yeah, and that was... that's how it all started. No, so we met at university. We were both doing science degrees, but we used to do AmDram. We used to do a lot of AmDram, and in particular, we met doing a Terry Pratchett adaptation of Weird Sisters. Who, funnily enough, I bumped into someone. Do you remember Shani, who helped produce it?
No,
there you go. We were doing that, and we discovered that we had very similar senses of humour. We both were into The Simpsons, Eddie Izzard, Terry Pratchett, Look Around You, all that sort of nonsense. We decided to sort of start working together on shows at uni.
Yeah, like I remember the lighting design in that show wasn't great, and you were doing a production of Inspector Calls next term.
And I needed someone to do the lighting.
And I was like, well, I've done lighting before, so shall I do lighting for that? And then when we did that show, we came up with another show. And we just sort of fell into working together, making sort of rubbish student theatre. And
it wasn't all terrible.
It wasn't all terrible, but it was hit and miss. So we just started working together and didn't stop.
Yeah, and then about, maybe 9-10 months, maybe a year after we met, we both independently started getting into magic.
No interest in magic before going to uni.
We had sort of interest as punters in that, you know, when I was a kid, I used to enjoy watching Paul Daniels on telly. I quite enjoyed watching The Masked Magician whenever it came up. And I was quite into Derren Brown. To the point where I remember I went to see Derren Brown live, the first show, his first stage show in the Swansea Grand Theatre. And I went with a mate who had bought Pure Effect and Absolute Magic. And he was like, he's just a magician. And I was like, no, he can really do it. I mean, isn't it impressive how he memorized the phone book and stuff like that? And you look back at it now and you go, that's quite nice not knowing, isn't it? It's quite fun. And so I bought a copy of Tricks of the Mind, or is it Trick of the Mind? What's it? It's called A Trick of the Mind, isn't it? Because the TV show is Tricks of the Mind. Yeah, is his first book for the public, and started playing around with little bits from that. And you were playing a lot of poker.
Yeah, well, so when I was a sort of teenager, I got really into juggling and circus skills and contact juggling and all that kind of stuff. And so I was always good at, always into like learning physical skills and like learning cool things to do with my hands and stuff. And at university, we used to play a lot of poker, like just like, you know, £1 buy-in kind of, just something to do during the day. And because I was rubbish at poker, like I just started learning to do cool shuffles and do chip shuffles and stuff, because it was the kind of stuff I learned to do. And then honestly, from that, YouTube suggested a magic trick, like some tutorial someone doing this, that, and the other. And that was, and I learned classic. That magic trick. And
you used to do that in close-up gigs.
You used to do that in close-up gigs. Yeah, yeah. And I learned that, and then I started learning false shuffles and stuff.
I learned this and the other.
And I learned this and that. And from that, I sort of then stumbled onto like forums and like the Talk Magic forum, I remember. And then people are like, oh, you should get Royal Road and you should get Expert Card Technique, and got into that. But yeah, very much got into it late, sort of weirdly through a juggling card manipulation direction.
And then we both found out that we'd sort of independently started playing around with card tricks. And so then it became the case of, well, I've just learned to do this. Can you do this? Oh, yes, I've just learned this. Oh, let me show you this. Is that fooled you? Not quite, but, you know. And so it led to a bit of a rivalry, but like, certainly an element of one-upmanship in like a friendly competition kind of way.
Well, I think one of the reasons that we developed quickly, I guess you'd put it, is that we had someone to share it with.
Yeah.
So
we had a magic club of two.
And yeah, that magic club met. We had a tiny little daily magic club that met every day. And it was just you and me. And we just sit in your room, in your student room in like the second year or whatever it was, and watch Darren Brown videos and deconstruct them.
And try and work out how the tricks were done. And
like any trick we did with the card, any trick we did with the cards or anything like that, we'd be like, right, how would you do that? Like that one where he springs the cards into the war.
Yeah.
How would you do that? And like we liked the puzzles. I mean, like a lot of magicians, I think we liked the puzzles of it.
And we had no money, so we bought very few books and very few DVDs.
So we just watch stuff or watch stuff on YouTube.
Yeah, and just play around with it, really.
And then from there, because we did stage shows together, we just started doing it. Like within like a year of picking up Royal Road, we were like, well, we should do a stage show.
Yeah, and our first stage show was, to say subpar would be an understatement. Our very first stage show, we were putting it together because it was very easy to put on shows when we were at uni. There were like 6 or 7 theatres that you bid for. You just had to write up a competent bid and you could go and do a show. And so we wrote a show called Box of Tricks. And 2 days before it was due to open, we showed it to two close friends of ours who were both in theatre. And we said, what do you think?
And they were like, oh, it's bad.
It's bad.
It's bad. So we rewrote it in 2 days.
Yeah, we wrote the entire show in 2 days. And from that, there was one bit in that, which was our halftime break. Which was, so we sort of had the semblance of the faux Victorian thing going on. We're in like grey tailcoats and top hats.
We were being kind of pompous.
We're being arrogant and horrible. And there was a halftime break where we got someone on stage and we offered them a cup of tea, but we basically did a riff on the cups and balls with teacups and sugar cubes and lemons and cakes and stuff like this. And it was, that was the bit that people liked.
Yeah.
That was the bit that people went, oh, that was really good. How was the rest of it? Well, that was really good.
Yeah.
You know, it was all right. So we'll drop the rest.
Yeah.
And we went from there, really. And that's where we started basing
everything on.
Yeah.
Now, while that was happening, were you doing, because you both mentioned, oh, at close-up gigs, everybody thinks of both of you as like working together on stage and that's it. Did you at any point ever take those skills that you learned and go out and gig in close-up environments?
Yeah, we've done close-up gigs.
Yeah, close-up. So it was funny, when we started out, we thought that if we were going to try and earn a living from magic, it was a toss-up between trying to learn a living from magic or trying to make a theatre company that dealt exclusively in Terry Pratchett shows, or possibly stand-up comedy with puppets. We hadn't quite worked out which yet.
We had a lot of ideas.
We had a lot of ideas.
And basically we went, oh, and we had this idea going, okay, well, there's money to be made in magic, so let's do this thing, and we'll become close-up magicians, and maybe every August we'll go to the Edinburgh Fringe and do a show there. But we assumed most of our living would come from doing close-up gigs, because I think when you start out in magic and you start reading the forums and talking to people and watching videos,
that's what people talk about, isn't it?
Everyone talks about close-up.
Especially in the time we were getting into it, which was the real sort of boom of the corporate close-up and the wedding industry, which was a couple of years after the 2008 financial crash.
Yeah.
So you're talking sort of 2009, 2010, 2011, when there was, you know, and Google optimization was reasonably straightforward and all of that sort of thing. It was when you could position yourself reasonably easily as someone that people would hire.
But the industry pointed us so much in the direction of doing close-up.
That's what we thought
that
we'd
do. Thought we'd end up doing. That's sort of thing on like the Magic subreddit today of people talking about like, what are your ambitions with Magic? And like everyone on there was saying, oh, I want to do things with my mates. I want to think, oh, I want to do street magic or things like this. And every now and then someone would be like, yeah, I want to be a close-up magician. I mean, obviously one day I'd love to do like a big stage show and stuff. But in that really weird, like, that's an impossible dream for the future, whereas close-up is a thing you can actually achieve.
Well, and also
which is a weird attitude, isn't it?
Like, well, and also the weird assumption that one leads to the other, when in fact they are kind of...
literally different.
They're picking different skill trees in an RPG, things, aren't they? You know, you are a magician. Do you go down the close-up skill tree? Do you put your points into the stage skill? You know, what do you do into the creating stuff skill tree? And so close-up gigs were always a funny one, especially the early days, because people would contact us and we'd say, well, do you want one or two people? And we would do stuff separately, but we would always split the money. If one of us went out to do a gig, we split the money between the two of us. That was, and it was always right. They just want one of us. Fine. You did the last one, so I'll do this one. Or actually, I can't do this one. I'm busy doing this. All right, I'll do this one again, but now you're going to have to, you know, that was the way it worked. And then about, we don't really do very much close-up at all anymore. But the last few close-up gigs, we suddenly realized the way we could make close-up bearable for ourselves was we do it as a double act. Now, and if you book us for close-up, you book us, and we turn up and interrupt you whilst you're having a chat with your mates, and
as all close-up workers do, but we do it with two of us
and we basically do a little mini play where it's about 9 minutes and it's something, you know,
you're doing tricks and business. But basically one of the things we found on stage is that the beauty of being a double act on stage is that you don't need to talk to the audience because you can talk to each other.
And so that's
basically
what we did.
From close-up we went, we can do this in close-up as well. We can do bits of business and shtick and stuff largely between ourselves.
I think actually people enjoy it more because they know that they're not being called upon. They don't have to have any input.
Yeah, pick a card, sign a thing. Oh, it's in your pockets. Like, you know, like, simple stuff, but yeah.
The input's minimal rather than
trying to get mileage out of people.
Yeah, it's
very quite... I've never seen anyone else kind of do that way of approaching close-up magic, but...
If there's two of you, it's really easy because you just sort of, you know, oh, hello. Yes. Oh, sorry to interrupt. Yes. Oh, no, we're the magicians. I'm Reese Morgan.
I'm West.
Together we are Morgan and West. But first of all, before we do any magic, obviously, there's a lot of admin that comes with it. And you just start off.
We just go and riff off each other and stuff. And because I think close up, you are doing a little mini performance for people. And magic's a funny one, I think, because it is a performance art form that is favoured by a lot of people that don't like performing. And I think one of the reasons that close-up is so popular is close-up can make you get to look smart and feel cool and be like, ha ha ha, bam, found your card, bosh, I'm the best, and walk off. And get paid for it, but without having to do the sort of embarrassing side of performing. Because there is a certain, when you do anything that's really performative, there's a certain vulnerability to it because you are doing something over the top, you are doing something larger than life, and that is something that some people that would feel silly doing. Whether it's dressing up in a costume, whether it's doing a funny voice, whether it's reacting to things or acting stupid or whatever, it's a bigger than like larger than life thing, and that is kind of embarrassing.
So
if
people,
you are ready to be embarrassed by it,
yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? I think people worry about the self-reflection that it is, what it says about them as a real person, whereas actually if you kind of sidestep that and go, well, it doesn't say anything about me as a real person,
it's my job, I'm doing a good job of it. Like you see far too many magicians trying really hard to look cool and just kind of looking a bit pompous and boring. And
because you either look cool or you don't.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to deliberately look cool, I think. Or at least, I think you have to look cool, you have to be the duck on the water, don't you? You have to be pedaling like Billy-O underneath, but no one can see your legs working. Yeah. And it's hard work.
And let's face it, doing card tricks doesn't make you James Bond.
No.
Like,
no. And also, I'm not sure that James Bond is cool.
No.
He's quite murdery.
Yeah.
So,
he's a violent misogynist. Yeah.
Yeah,
so our thing was, in terms of the performance, I really truly believe that there is great success to be found in the close-up world as a larger-than-life performer who does close-up. And if you look at someone like Williamson, who was obviously David Williamson, who's done a lot of close-up work in his time, David Williamson on stage is the same performer he is in close-up. Yeah. Like, he's still this big, larger-than-life character, and, like, he's not there trying to look cool. He's still being stupid and being over the top. And that works in close-up just as well as it works on stage. You just have to accept that you're going to look a bit silly, and that's fine because people like people that look silly.
Yeah, and it doesn't even have to be look silly. It can just be...
Just commit to something.
Yeah, it's that commitment, isn't it? It's the commitment to a bit, essentially, yeah. And working out what bit suits you best.
Yeah,
is the thing, and also working out. I think it takes a long time in magic to work out that it's not that the tricks don't matter, because the tricks have to be good and they have to be actual magic tricks, but they matter the least.
Yeah,
in that it's a really weird thing with magic, in that the tricks have to be a certain level. They have to be magic, but after that, doesn't matter.
The magic trick is the foundation of your performance.
Yes.
And without it,
it has to be solid.
The house falls down. You need a foundation.
But you never want to see it.
You don't want to live on foundations. You want to live on whatever it is you build on top of those foundations.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of performers, what they build on top of the foundations is a suit and three jokes.
Mm. It's because magic is a lot of different things to a lot of people. Like, yeah, it can be a hobby to some people. It can be a performance art to others. It can be a craft to others. And I think it's when it blurs those lines, because again, like, it's how we started out, was it started as a hobby, and then all of a sudden we realized we could earn some money from this. Yeah. And so you sort of, it becomes that weird line between, is this a hobby?
Is this a job?
Is this just something I do for fun?
Well, look at all the tricks over the years we've bought, or all the sleight of hand we've learned and never used in a gig.
Yeah.
Because that's the hobby side of it, isn't it? Buying new things, getting excited about new things, learning new sleights. That's the hobby side of it. But realistically, you know, our close-up set for years was cards to pocket, a transposition of a signed business card, and maybe one other thing. Like, you know, like, that's a torn corner bit.
One bit by Jay Sankey, one bit that we found from the World Magic Shop 2010 free DVD given away at Blackpool.
Yeah.
And one bit that was a sort of a mashup of various cards to locations. That was it.
And I think once you start to identify that difference between, I am learning this because it's fun.
Yeah.
And I am learning this because it will actively benefit my career. I'm doing this because it will actively benefit my career.
Everyone's very quick to monetize their hobby these days. And it's very easy to.
Yeah.
With things like Etsy and eBay and all that sort of thing. And I think it's part of it is reteaching ourselves that it doesn't... You can do stuff for fun. And that's fine. Yeah. In fact, that's good.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's a good thing, you know?
Absolutely.
Sorry, that was quite a long-winded way of asking.
That's how we got together.
Absolutely fascinated. I want to pick up on a couple of points before we continue, which is, first of all, obviously, you went through university together, and you put on your first show, which was terrible, other than the teacup section.
Oh, that was still pretty bad. it worked. Yeah.
But then you obviously left university. You decided immediately to become professional performers and focus on magic.
Not quite.
Well, so yes and no.
We had a 5-year plan, year one and two involved going and getting our PGCEs and becoming secondary school teachers.
Yeah.
Whilst at the same time,
because I couldn't get PhD funding.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I was always going down PGC route, but yeah. Whilst at the same time, we were doing lots and lots of increasing numbers of shows on. There's a circuit in Britain called the National Rural Touring Forum, the NRTF, which was established sometime in the noughties with a bunch of government funding, where it set up in individual counties it gave pockets of money for people to put on professional theatre in local village halls.
Yeah, rural communities.
In so rural
small villages.
Where they'd be subsidised or they'd guarantee the fee such that it didn't matter if they didn't sell enough tickets, et cetera, et cetera. And then the funding stopped and the ones that had been very, very successful carried on as their own little entities, and the ones that haven't been so successful either disappeared or got bought up. And now there's still a few of them around, like the one in Dorset is called Arts Reach.
Yeah.
And in Cheshire is Arts Allied. Happens, yeah, yeah.
Night Out.
And Norse. North Star, I think. And there's a few around, but the NRTF still exists. You can Google it, National Rural Touring Forum.
And so we were teachers for a couple of years, but every weekend we would be driving to the arse end of nowhere in the UK to do a stage show to 15 people in a village hall.
And then driving back on and getting home at 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning on Monday morning, ready to then get up at 6 to go and teach at 8.
And, 12, you know, yeah.
It was
Like when I handed in my notice at school, the head of science, my boss, went, "You do look exhausted."
But in that period, we were also working on our shows. We were doing shows at the Edinburgh Fringe at that point. We'd done 2 or 3 by then. And that's where a lot of our work came from. And we also were applying for, you know, you keep your eye on Magic Week and apply for whatever. And in October 2010, a thing came up on Magic Week going, Penn and Teller are doing a show in the UK and we need applicants. And we went, send it off. And we ended up filming the pilot for Fool Us, which is the one that John Archer and Ben Earl both fooled them on. And we filmed the pilot and we didn't get aired. And that was our first bittersweet taste of television, was the excitement of, we're going to be on TV, this is going to be amazing. And then 2 days before it broadcasts, phone call saying, we're not airing you.
Especially because at that time, we definitely had bought into the myth of the big break.
Yeah, yeah.
With John Berger.
But
we bought into the myth of like, there will be a moment that will be your big break. And we were like, well, this is it. This is the thing that launches our career. And then it got taken away from us. And we were like, oh. And actually, in reality, that's not how life works. That's not how careers work. There won't be one moment that defines everything for you. Stuff happens and things go wrong, things go badly.
And you might look back on it. There might be moments that do change things.
But that was good for us. But you need to carry on doing
lead up to that moment, aren't there? You know, like applying, for example. But we ended up doing the series, and in the series, somehow we fooled them, which was as much of a surprise to us as it was to them.
Yes, indeed.
That was the catalyst for leaving the job 6 months earlier than we thought we were going to.
Yeah.
Because
the plan was always to go, but we were like, oh, we're now getting a few opportunities to do things sooner than we thought. So
yeah, because we got to go out to Adelaide to do the Adelaide Fringe for 6 weeks, and because of the various syndications, that series of Fool Us was going to get aired at about the time that we would go out there if we quit our jobs and went that year rather than waiting. So we're like, right, that'll help sales and blah, 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 blah. And so then we went full time, basically. In January 2012, we'd gone full time.
Yeah.
So how important would you say it is for somebody watching this that's a hobbyist, they're where you were when you first started, they're desperate to be a full-time magician. How important is it, do you think, to have that 5-year plan? Because a lot of people don't do that. A lot of people go, I'm going to give it my job. I'm going to go and become a full-time magician. I don't have any work. Right, crap. You know,
I don't think it needs to be 5 years. It doesn't, there's no set period, but I do think you need to have a plan. And I think the most important thing, and
you need to have goals. You need to have smart targets. You need to have smart targets.
Sustainable, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timed.
Yeah. There you go. Bit of teaching jargon for you.
But I think the important thing as well, just with goals in general in something like magic, is that if you are a same professional or an amateur or even a professional and your goal is 5 years from now, I want to be doing a stage show, your plan can't be do close up for 5 years until someone gives me a stage show.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you want to do it, be a stage magician.
You've got to have all the steps to get there.
On day one, you've got to start working towards that thing. If your goal is to be on TV, again, it can't be do wedding gigs until I do a wedding where someone happens to be a TV producer and they go, you kid, I'm going to make you a star. Because that doesn't happen.
Because if they are doing that, they're taking the piss.
Exactly.
Like, no one
talks
like
one that. Needs to be working towards being on TV. And if it's corporate, day one is to be working towards corporate. Like, And whereas I think a lot of magicians do think that
there are shortcuts, because obviously magic is entirely shortcuts.
Yes, it's all cheating. It's like the way to do this impossible thing is actually that you don't do that, you just do this instead.
Yeah.
And I think that magicians get confused that when it comes to your career,
or anything that isn't a magic trick.
People assume that there's one weird tip that professional magicians don't want you to know, and if you click this link, it'll tell you how to become an instant success. And if you look at any successful magician, who, like, whether they're a stage performer or a TV performer or anything, like, they will have been knocking on the doors of that thing for years. And so people will say to us when they see us touring, because we tour reasonable sized theatres, 300-500 seat theatres.
And smaller and bigger. And we don't, you know, we fill them sometimes, we don't fill them other times. Yeah. It's the good, you know, you roll with everything.
But
you do what you can.
But they look at the kind of venues we're playing. People will turn up to a nice venue we're playing and they say, you're in the Derby Theatre. How do you book a tour like that? And they seem to think that we were doing close up one day and someone went to us, oh, by the way, do you want to do a national tour? I was like, we've done every, like, if you ever find yourself in a part of England where there's no phone signal and there's a village hall and some cows, we've played that village hall.
And played to those cows because
there was no one in the audience.
There's hardly anyone there.
Like, we've done every bad gig you can imagine. We've played in tents, we've played in gardens, we've played in people's front rooms, in the corners of pubs, like, in rooms that are...
I've been bitten by a dog in a corner of a pub that we went to.
Yeah.
And the owner was like, oh, sorry, he's a bit aggressive. He's like, he's just bitten my... I'm bleeding. I'm literally bleeding. Yeah, he's not that keen on tattoos. Yeah. Well, don't have him here then.
We've played in venues upstairs from gigs that were so hot. They were like, we were literally like drenched in sweat afterwards. We played outdoors in gigs that were so cold we couldn't feel our hands. Like, we've done every bad stage gig.
And we've done every nice one as well.
But I think people only see that end bit.
Yeah.
They only see the bit where they go, well, that's the bit I don't want that. I don't want to do crappy gigs. I want to do nice gigs. And they don't realise that the reason we're good enough to do nice gigs...
Well, and you don't know it's a nice gig until halfway through.
Yeah, and we've done gigs that look nice and really aren't. But the way you get to do nice gigs is going, well, we have really robust stage material. And you get really robust stage material by doing less nice gigs. And the way you book in those nice gigs is by having sales figures. And the way you do sales figures is by doing fringes and by doing small regional venues and doing all the bad stuff on the way.
We did our first tour in 2013, in the September of 2013. And up to that point, we'd done 3.5 years of doing these rural touring gigs.
Yeah.
And in fact, we carried on doing rural touring gigs right up until 2017.
Yeah.
When we decided we were now touring enough in regular theatres, making enough money from regular theatres that we could drop the rural touring. And the way the first tour happened was we had spent 2 or 3 years turning up at Objective Productions every now and again, back when they were called Objective Productions, and auditioning for, like, Help My Spy Teacher's Magic, and that one they made for Discovery, Breaking Magic. Turning up and being seen by Anthony Owen and Andy Nyman and sort of putting our faces around. And every time we went to the Fringe and on the lead up, emailing Michael Vine and being like, hello, why don't you come and see us? Because you might like us and you might want to be our agent. And Michael being like, well, I don't want to be your agent.
I'm Pete Furman's agent.
Yeah, you know. But he then put, he eventually, I think we'd badgered him enough and I bumped into him in enough queues for Chris Cox's show, funnily enough, that he sent Corey Maguire along.
He was like, I think it's time I sent Corey down to see you. But by this point, we were in a 120-seat room in the Edinburgh Fringe.
And this was
We've been selling out for some years now.
That's our fifth Edinburgh Fringe.
Edinburgh Fringe. We've been selling that room to packed audiences for years, just off ourselves flying.
Yeah.
Like, just the two of us pressing flesh on the street, as it were.
And Corrie came to see the show, and she really liked it. It was very different to any of the magic shows she'd seen. And she said, right, well, let's have a meeting. We went into London. She said, what do you want? We said, we want a tour. And she said, great. Do you want to do TV? And we said, not really. We're not that bothered, but touring is what we want. She's like, great, because when you're not on TV, you tour to make money. And when you are on TV, you tour to make money.
Yeah.
So, because I think she got a lot of people who were there saying, oh, I want to
be Darren
TV.
Brown, I want my own TV special.
Mm-hmm. And so then she was our agent for a couple of years. And they booked live tours for us for a while. And then various things moved and changed. And in 2016, we went our separate ways from Objective. Because then we had a new booking agent who is just a theatre booker, a chap called Mark Makin, who just books
theatrical shows, plays and comedians and bands and all sorts.
And he toured Luke Jermaine for a while because we put him onto Luke, and so that's where we are now. Is we tour through him, and a few things that we get ourselves every now and again, but that's about it, really.
But again, part of that thing, again, people talk a lot about wanting to get an agent, but they forget that...
Dave Gorman gave us a piece of advice once. We happened to become friendly with Dave Gorman because of a weird situation where we ended up in one of his books.
Yeah.
And we were talking to him on the Royal Mile in Edinburgh in 2011. We were talking to him about, you know, we haven't got an agent. And he was like, here's the thing.
You'll get an agent when you need one.
Yeah. If you need an agent, they'll come knocking. Yeah. If you don't need an agent, they won't come knocking.
Because agents take a cut of what you earn. Like, and obviously they will try and get you more work, but it's not that thing where you're someone who's got lots of talent but no gigs, and an agent turns around and goes, I recognize your talent, I'm going to get you tons of gigs. No, agents come along to people who are already making money and going, I'll do some of the admin for you and take some of that money you're making.
And maybe if I throw you against the wall...
get you into some TV commissioner's office or something.
I mean, look at the big comedy agency in the UK, Avalon, where their model is, are you a semi-competent comedian who does all right with gigs? Yes, great. In you come. We will throw you every panel show. We will pitch you every TV thing. And at some point, you might stick.
Yeah.
And if you stick, we'll make a bunch of money out of you.
Yeah. But those comedians are already gigging. They've already got the material.
Yeah. Like, that's the agent model. That's how it works.
The thing that I'm getting from this is, for anybody that's watching this that wants to be a success, they want to be doing what you're doing, it's not going to happen overnight. It's a lot of hard work and it's a lot of busting your ass. You guys spent the best part of a decade, if not more, becoming an overnight success, right?
Everyone does. Any overnight success is, you know, it's a long night. It's a long overnight period.
Yeah.
That encompasses many days as well.
And I think we often say this when talking about sort of our work in general, is that if you want to make it, again, as a close-up magician, as a corporate magician, as a cruise magician, as a stage magician, whatever it is, you can't only want to do the end bit because you won't last. Mm. We've done tons of bad gigs. We have done tons of bad gigs, but we've done tons of gigs in less than desirable circumstances, under strip lighting in a school hall to 15 people. And a lot of those have been very pleasant shows to do that we've really enjoyed doing. Because if you don't enjoy the journey, you will never make it to the end. And
cool, you will make it to the end and you'll be sad.
Yeah. You know? And I think it's why a lot of magicians fixate on money, is after a while they realize they don't particularly enjoy doing close-up, but it's all they can do. So they just focus on, well, if the next gig pays me more, the next gig pays me more, the next gig pays me more, it'll be worthwhile. Whereas our attitude is like, I'd rather
find the thing that interests you, find the things that make you comfortable and happy, and also both in terms of mentally and in terms of physically, in terms of everyone's got means by which they need to live, and all of those things. You need to look at the whole picture and decide what it is that you want, and not what will be the next step, and then chase the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, because otherwise you'll spend your entire life chasing stuff.
Yeah.
So we've now reached a point where we always said that the thing we wanted to do was to tour our own shows and earn enough money to live. And that's what we do.
That's what we do now.
And we make new shows because that interests us.
Yeah.
And that's fun to do. And that's exciting and new. But we're not chasing, like, we're not kind of like, and now we've done this, now we want to be in the West End, or now we want to be on Broadway, or now we want to go to Vegas, or anything like that. It's just like, I quite enjoy touring sort of 200 to 500 seat regional theatres. It's quite nice.
Yeah. And like, and there's also that thing of, again, with the sort of talking about plans and having a plan for it, is that we always wanted to tour our work and make a living doing that. And we didn't wait until we were touring to make our stuff tourable, if you know what I mean. Like, when we were doing Village Halls, we were bringing loads of set with us. We couldn't bring lights with us. We didn't have room in the car. But we had, like, really complicated sound design running off a remote control in our own pocket, playing on a computer in the way. Like, we brought tons of stuff with us because we're like, well, when you're working theatres, we like shows that have loads of set and that look really good when you walk in. And so that's the show we want to create. So we started creating that even when we were only doing it in a village in Piddle Hinton.
Out of the back of a Honda Jazz.
Yeah, and we're talking about the back of a Honda Jazz. Like, we were trying to create the work that we would one day create from the start. And obviously it's grown and expanded from that. But even in our early shows,
we were working within our means, but we were pushing the very edge of what our means were.
Yeah,
I think.
Well, here's a question. The fact that you're a double act and have been right from the very beginning, and you talked about how you used to do close-up gigs and split the money if you went out individually, was that help or hindrance? Because I can imagine it's a help in many ways, but I mean, if you, for example, in the early days went out and did close-up and didn't have a partner, well, you'd be making all the money yourself. I mean, surely at the very, very beginning, there were financial issues of going down that kind of business model. Or was it always like the best? I suppose what I'm asking for people that are watching this, that's got a best friend that are listening to this and they go, I'm going to make this. I'm going to grab my best friend. We're going to put a show together. Like, what are the pros and cons of being a double act?
The cons is that it's the same money split between two people.
Yeah.
That's a big con.
Yeah. Even if there's two of you at a gig, you're not charging double.
Yeah. And there's twice the cost associated. Yeah. The cons is there's always someone to talk to. There's always someone to share. There's always someone to share the successes with, and there's always someone to commiserate with.
Yeah.
Because if you have a bad gig,
and you're driving 3 hours home,
you just get into your head about it. Whereas if there's two of you, you can moan like buggery about it, and then afterwards,
you just vent
about it.
And then it's done, and then it's over. And if it's good, you can celebrate with someone, and also I think just critique. Like, it's very hard after your own gig to go, right, what was good about that? What was bad about that? What could I change? Whereas with two of us, we can say, oh, I didn't like that. I did like this.
The first thing we do when we come off stage is we don't congratulate each other. We say, we go through, that was an issue. Is that an actual issue, or does that happen tonight? Oh, that bit that you tried there, or that bit was the way you did that was really good. Let's keep that in. It's the highlights and the lowlights. We go through those very quickly. And then we might say, oh, good job, by the way. Well done. Yeah. But that's kind of taken as written. It's been an interesting learning experience because for the new show, we're working with a third person. And after the first show we did with them, we had to have a bit of a conversation. We went, oh, I think they think that we're really down on the show.
Yeah. Because we walk off and sound super negative. We're like, didn't like that. But it comes from, we are so used to working with each other. It is taken as read that we like the work.
Because if we didn't like the work, we'd walk away. Yeah. And we say, I can't do this. Let's do something different.
And it's taken as read that we will be happy with the show when we're really happy with it. And yeah, we got laughs and people liked it. And people were like, all the good stuff is fine, but I can see 15 problems with the show.
Yeah.
And I'll be really happy 2 months from now and 20 gigs from now when those 15 problems are fixed. And obviously by then we'll have found 15 more problems, but there'll be smaller problems. And we realized that, oh yeah, when we're working with someone that doesn't know us, we need to also do the positive bit.
Yeah.
Because it's very easy to just go, this is rubbish, this is rubbish, this is rubbish. And I think people are like, God, I think you hate doing this. I'm like, no, we love doing this. It's just our process. This is just how we work on things. And I think having a second person does force you to have higher standards because there's another person, so you can't just go, it's good enough, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, the most important thing, though, about if you are going to work with a second, third, fourth person, however many, is that you need to have an open and honest discussion about what you're all aiming for and how much effort you are all willing to put in to get there.
Yeah.
Because there is no point in... So, for example, if in our double act, if Early Doors, one of us had really wanted to be on television and the other had really wanted to be on stage, then that's, you're going your separate ways.
Because one of us would be then like, I think we should write another TV pitch. I think we should send that TV pitch out. I think we should phone that TV producer. I think we should build it. And the other one would be like, I just want to work on the current show and not do that because I can't be bothered.
Yeah.
You need to be on the same page. And also how hard you're willing to work. And one is like, let's rehearse every night. And one is like, let's rehearse once a month.
That's,
you're going in different directions again.
And if there is a disparity between those things, then you can still work together. That doesn't mean it's not to say you have to be exactly aligned all the time, but by being open and honest about those disparities, you can make informed decisions about whether or not you want to carry on with that.
Yeah.
Because it's essentially a relationship. Yeah. What we have is essentially a marriage.
Yeah.
In that we have to work together on everything and things get shared out in different proportions. So for example, Rob makes a lot of the costume. I don't make any costume. And you have to be comfortable with that. There can't be this thing where I'm sat at home then going, well, I haven't made any costume. I feel really guilty about that. I need to do something. I'm going to go and make this stick figure out of cement. Ah, here we go. What's that for?
Well, I don't know, but I felt bad about not making it.
You know, you can't do that.
Well, years and years ago, Penn and Teller did a show in London, and in their program for that show, they have a guide to being a double act. And one of them is don't worry about who ordered the tuna salad. The idea being that at some point, one of you will do more, or not even really earn more other than in our early days, but like we'll do more of the work or more of this or get more of the laughs or whatever. And the point is that it's important not to care about that, because the act is bigger than both of you. And if I'm spending, you know, 3 weeks staying up until midnight every night, desperately trying to finish the costumes that I promised for this show, like, I'm not going to be there begrudging the fact that Reese isn't doing that, because that is something that I am doing for the show. And there's lots of stuff that Reese does for the show that's all going towards making the show as good as it can be. I mean, obviously, it's worth pointing out with the double act thing, but obviously our entire career comes with a hefty weight of sort of white middle class privilege.
All the privilege. Oh my.
You know, and you can't discount that.
No.
But also, we were gigging very regularly at the same time as doing full-time jobs.
That doesn't mean that we haven't worked hard, but yeah, we definitely started on level five.
Know. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
With a couple of cheat codes active.
Yeah.
And it's important to acknowledge those things and to, again, work within and to your means.
Yeah.
I think those are important things.
And you two have an undeniable chemistry on stage. Is that something that you worked on, or did that come from being friends? Because I remember you talked about Penn and Teller. One thing that I've heard Penn and Teller say in the past is the way that they've kept their relationship going for so long is they're not friends outside of the show. You know, they openly say that when they're outside of, they don't have anything to do with each other. Is how have you developed that chemistry, and is that the case with you guys as well?
It's a funny one, because I think when we first heard that about Penn and Teller, we couldn't imagine what that was. I think we now have a better understanding of what they actually mean. I think they're saying that is a shorthand for what the actual situation is.
So obviously we've always been very good friends, and from the moment we met, we really got on, and we sort of clicked, as it were, as mates, and really enjoyed working together. But at the same time, we spend a lot of time together doing work.
And so we don't need to spend a lot of time together socially in each other's company. Yeah. Especially because I think people don't realise that if you are a double act, you get a lot of that social time in the times that you're travelling to and from gigs. Because if you've got like a 3-hour journey to a gig, and then you've got to set up the gig, and then you've got to have dinner, and then you've got a 3-hour journey back, in a day, as well as all the time you spent actually working, you spent like 7 hours in each other's company anyway.
Yeah.
So
we're probably then not going to go to the pub afterwards, because what would we say?
You know,
what have you been up to?
Oh, doing that shit you were there.
Yeah, actually. I was there. Yeah, I was there.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and is that thing of, so yeah, so arguably we don't socialize because we do a fun job that we enjoy doing, and we often go out for dinner together, and we often spend lots of time together, because that's our job.
We say that if we're doing a show somewhere, if we're doing two shows in a day and we're kind of going out for a meal between the shows or going out for coffee or something, people must find it very, very odd.
They must think we hate each other because we're sat there on our phones, like texting our partners or reading the news or whatever. And they're going, these two aren't speaking to each other.
Just
like we've talked for four hours already that day.
So over the last 15 months during COVID, where there's been, you've been unable to gig, has there been more socializing because you haven't had that traveling tour from the gig, or have you replaced it? Do you know what I mean?
It's been weird because we were mid tour when everything shut down. We were literally, we were like show 12 of a 50 date tour when everything stopped.
That's gone.
The first couple of months were us sort of working out, is this going to start up again?
Yeah.
Then sort of doing other bits and bobs like video for a while and playing with different ideas. Then the Musketeers show sort of reared up. And you've moved house.
Yeah, I moved house.
Although it's been a long 15 months, it's kind of, for us, it's changed every couple of months in the way that we're doing things anyway.
Yeah, because it's always like, and like, we've done something, we tried some YouTube stuff, we tried some streaming stuff. We've done a bunch of stuff, largely to keep ourselves busy.
Yeah.
And obviously, we've spent way less time talking to each other, but we've still talked to each other a lot about stuff and made stuff and worked on stuff. And Yeah, or just, yeah, or you've helped me move house, and you know, and all that kind of stuff.
I carried most of this stuff up this stairs. Exactly, yeah. You know, it's just like, so yeah, it's just gently evolved to adapt to the situation, I think, hasn't it?
Yeah, and like we're in a lucky position now where, while like, you know, we're very busy again, we have lots of work coming, but also we're at a stage in our career now where if you can survive 15 months without work in a global pandemic and come out of that pandemic and suddenly have a full diary again, this is primarily thanks to our booker, but also because of the relationships and the reputation we built up with venues, that means that we can take a bit of time off from time to time. Mm. So now we can go, okay, well, we've got this show, Musteers, that we've obviously worked on over lockdown, worked on things like that. So the next time we do a show, we can take time off to work on the show. And we can sort of change our working habits, because for years and years and years we've worked on one thing while touring another thing. Mm.
And we're getting old.
Yeah,
we're getting old.
And
I might not look it, but I'm 63. Yeah. Like, you know, it's just
and actually COVID's, I think, been really good for teaching us, like, actually a slightly slower pace of work is not a bad thing.
Yeah, we were very much
While the sun shines.
Yeah, yeah. And that was useful because it meant that when it absolutely chucked it down,
we had hay.
Yeah. We had hay. But we had too much hay.
Yeah.
And so we made too much of it, and so we worked too much. And so we now need to pull back a little bit. And it's like, for a lot of people, I think the last 15 months has caused everyone to take a bit of a step back and reassess what's important in their lives. And this, what we do, is definitely important to us. But it's perhaps not the amount of importance we had ascribed to it was perhaps more than either of us realized or needed.
Well, and there was definitely a time when we were doing like 250 gigs a year.
Oh, God, yeah. And we were exhausted. Like,
because we were regularly doing 250 shows, or the gigs. We would often do two or three shows in a day.
And these were shows anything from 60 minutes to a full sort of evening show with an interval. Well, I remember there was one February half term. We did 15 shows in 7 days.
Yeah.
And each day was at a different venue. And yeah, sometimes the venues were
miles and
200
miles
apart.
Yeah, 2 or 3 hours apart. But there was definitely a point at which we sort of were like, oh, God, but we're kind of proud of that.
Yeah.
We were
like,
we're doing 250 gigs this year. And like,
whereas now we're kind of like, I just can't imagine doing it. I think I'd die.
I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to. And specifically, I don't want to be doing 5 different shows in a year, as in 5 different. So like a kid's show and a Christmas show. So I don't want to be doing that in a year now. I want to do one show for a year.
From August 2019 to December 2019, in that period, we did a load of shows. I don't know how many exactly. Off the top of my head, Edinburgh, that tour, Christmas, probably about 70 or 80 shows.
Yeah.
And within that 70 or 80 shows, there were 6 different shows that we were doing.
Yeah, we did our 2 different kids shows,
which were 60 minutes each.
Our 2 different evening shows.
But evening shows, 90 minutes with an interval each, and a Christmas show and a science show, which were an hour long each. So there were 5, 6, there were 7 hours of different shows. And it's not just kind of like 7 hours of tricks. It was 7 shows, 7 hours of shows. And at the time we were kind of like, ooh. And as we started doing it, we're like, this is a nightmare. I can't remember half of this stuff. I don't know how I'm putting this in my head.
And we're spending all our off time swapping the van over in the lockup. Whereas like now I've got to a stage now where obviously I like to work and I like to tour.
But I want to do a show
for 6 months or for 3 months or however long the tour is. I want to do a show for a bit, put that show away for a couple of years, take out another one, tour that one, and maybe have a couple of months off in between.
I was talking to Danny Hunt the other day, because Danny has had a similar attitude towards work for forever.
Do everything.
And he and Steph would be like going out on Boxing Day to take back the illusions they'd hired out to Pantos. And they were doing this show here and changing the van over and driving through the middle of the night. And he said to me, I'm just tired of doing that now. Yeah. The last 15 months have told me I just don't want to do that anymore. And I was like, yep, we've come to that realization as well, mate. It's a bit much, isn't it? It's a bit much. But I think it's very easy to get caught up in that. It's very easy to, it becomes habitual.
I think so much of magic in particular, but a lot of the world at the moment because of social media, is about being like a visible success.
Mm.
And it's that weird thing of, in magic, because we can't really, we're not competitive other than FISM. We don't compete with each other. So the only ways you can really measure your success is how many gigs you do, how much money you earn, or maybe the fact you have a TV show.
Yeah.
And for most of us, that third one's out. So it then becomes this thing of going, well, I did 200 gigs this year. Well, I made X amount of money this year. Clearly, I'm a big deal. Whereas actually being like, I actually would rather earn slightly less and have more time at home.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here's a question. You guys have been insanely busy up until COVID. What made you decide to start releasing magic tricks to magicians? I mean, you bought out the cards across through, and you bought out the parlor tricks through Vanishing It. Like, what? You've got 250 shows a year. You are completely stretched to the limit. I know. Let's bring some tricks out. Like, what was the reasoning behind that?
So we've got three releases out. We've got Thought of Cards Across, mm-hmm. which is the card trick. Across. And the reason we released that was because it cost us 50 quid a throw to make up the set of cards.
Because it was like thin cards and mispipped cards. And we were like, this is costing us a fortune every time. If we lose a set, it would take us too dirty a thing.
And we're
like,
and we're doing it every night. We're doing it for cabarets and we're doing it every night in parlor tricks and all this sort of thing. So we approached Vanishing Ink, who's put us onto Card Shark.
Basically, if you make this,
can we have
like 10 sets?
So we've just got 10 sets. Yeah. 10 sets and we made a bit of money. Great, lovely.
We genuinely released that so that Card Shark would make us the cards.
Yeah, so that would be nice and that would be easy. Done. The
decoded stuff was...
Decoded was because no one talks about code. And we lecture code and we think that coding is like one of those sort of... It's like... any card, any number. It's one of those weird
sort of mythic tricks
where actually it's really easy.
Yeah.
It's so easy. If there's two of you, just start making stuff up and working it out because that's how we did it. And there's a lot of bad stuff about coding out there as well. Like the chapter in Corinda is dreadful.
It's dreadful. It's not written by Corinda, but yeah, it's really bad that way. And there's the thing about we are kind of, some of our work I think is sort of deliberately contrarian in a way, in the we look at things in the industry that we or in magic that we don't like, and we try and lean against that.
Doing
the way that we like. And one of the things I think we felt was that coding and code work was one of those things that is sort of artificially inflated in terms of hype. Like the code acts and people talking about code were suggesting that there was like a godlike level of skill that no mortal, even in the magic industry, could understand if you weren't part of the inner circle.
And it's actually just, it's a lot of work.
And we were just like, I think this is interesting stuff and accessible stuff. People just assume there's tons of work in it. They assume, and we're like, I think we could do a nice, fun, like bare bones to complicated all the way through.
Like, here's the building blocks.
And here's how you build with them.
Yeah.
Partly to just show that like this stuff isn't actually that hard, and you know
you can do stuff with it that is really hard. It doesn't need to be. It can be as accessible as like a key card trick or something like that. You know, card tricks don't need to be and then I've done a pass and a master push off and blah 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 blah. They can be a key card or you know that's the thing.
Yeah, and I think in an industry where a lot of performers and a lot of ideas about performing are put on a pedestal about, I never use gimmicks, I only sleight of hand, like, it's that, I think we felt code was one of those things, and we're like, I think you could do a really nice sort of like, here's how coding works, at least the way we did it.
Yeah, and then Parlor Tricks, which has just gone into its third printing and is back in stock now, we wanted to write a magic book like no other magic book we'd read. And the closest book that we'd read to what we wanted to do was something like the Books of Wonder, Tom Stone's books, and also...
Any Dutch magic book?
Well, and also The Mental Mysteries of Hector Chadwick.
Yeah.
Where, and in that one, Hector Chadwick / Stephen Long talks quite in detail, takes you through blow by blow a show that he made and did, and did at the Edinburgh Fringe in like 2006, 2007. It was just before we were up, wasn't it? It was just before our time. And we found that really interesting, sort of talking about a show, and we thought, well, can we take this a step further? Can we not just sort of talk about the show and sort of do the tricks, but actually if we did this of, here's a video of the show, here's us talking about the way we set things up, here's us talking about the set, the sound, the lights, here's the script, here's decisions about, here's notes about why we make these decisions that we do in the script, here's the methods for the tricks, here's a discussion about what happens at the end of the show, the interval, where it's going. So it is literally the book of the show.
Because, yeah, like so many magic books, even if it's books on stage magic, are like, here's a trick, here's a trick, here's a trick, here's a trick. And then I go, and then get four routines and stick them together. Off you go. I'm like, there's a lot of work that goes into making a good show and crafting a show. And
Parlor Tricks is a show that we were confident in because it had been around since 2014 and we had completely reworked it from the ground up at least once, if not twice.
Yeah. So we're like, we put a lot of work into this show. And so we go like, yeah, sure, we'll teach our cars a cross trick. But we also want to talk about the fact that that trick started life as a completely different trick and went through several iterations before it got there. Because it's easy to give the impression that we go, yeah, we just write absolute bangers when it comes to tricks, which is not true. We write the same mediocre rubbish that everyone else writes, and then you just refine it and refine it and refine it and refine it.
Out of the 2014 Edinburgh Fringe Show parlor tricks that shared the same name, there are two tricks that survive to the 90-minute evening show. Because the rest, at one point, I remember doing it... it was an NRTF gig. I remember we did it, and we came away from that one, and we both looked at each other and we went, I think this show isn't good.
I think it's rubbish, yeah.
And sort of had to go, right, well, what are we going to do about it? Well, we could fix this or this, this. And it was actually, no, actually, I think it all needs to go. Yeah. I think there's these bits are fine, but the rest needs to go. And we need to think about this again and start again.
Yeah, and then one by one, we just started replacing the tricks.
Yeah, yeah.
Gosh, remember that dreadful any card at every number we did?
Yes.
Oh, that was really
bad.
Yes,
I do. Yeah, using the cooler.
Yeah, using the cooler. That was rubbish.
Which you just don't need to use on stage.
Yeah.
You absolutely don't need
you
to
don't
use
need
it.
You don't need devices to switch decks on stage. You've got a stage.
And there was another trick that we wrote that was really complicated where the idea was that because there's two of us, we could be getting away with stuff while you're not looking. So one of us is always going to be doing something whilst the other one's doing the trick. And so one of us will be talking whilst the other one was juggling. And there's nothing more distracting on stage than someone stood going while someone else is trying to do something.
Yeah.
Didn't realize it at the time. Did it a few times. Like, why isn't this playing? And then we watched the video and we went, because all I'm doing is watching you juggle badly. And I was like, yeah, I'm not really good at juggling. Sorry. So, you know, it's just like,
yeah.
But if you don't try this stuff, you don't know.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And you can't, it's also, you can't just try it once.
And that's the thing. A lot of magicians are scared of taking risks. They don't want to try something like that because they're afraid of looking stupid or silly. Whilst the only way to develop a show that you've developed over and over again, developing new shows and new shows and new shows, is trying something and seeing if it works.
Yeah. The number of times we've done tricks for an audience where at the end of a trick, you can hear that sort of polite,
I guess, well, they're bowing. So yeah,
I guess they're clapping now.
Yeah.
And you have to do it more than once as well, because if you try something for an audience, be it a stage audience or a close-up audience, once and it gets a bad reaction, they might be a bad audience. You might have fluffed something. If you try it five times and you get the same bad reaction every time, it's probably a bad trick.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to, listening to your audience is important, but also learning to assess whether your audience is worth listening to.
Yeah.
Is also important, and that only comes with time.
Basically, it's the magic equivalent of that thing of like, if you go out and you meet a dickhead, you met a dickhead. If you go out and everyone you meet is a dickhead, you're a dickhead.
You know,
it's that thing of, yeah, if you go out and tank, you tanked. If you go out and tank continuously, your material's bad.
Yeah.
Well, here's a question for you. You guys are quite unique in that you loved theatre first and then you found magic and you use that to be able to put on shows. Most people, they find magic and then they, you know, it's kind of the other way around.
Hmm.
Here's a question. If, hypothetical situation, if you had the opportunity to present it to you where you could tour theatrically but not do any magic, like the new show that you're doing right now, and you could sustain that forever at the same level of income and the same touring schedule, or you were able to do the same thing with magic and you had to pick one or the other, I'm trying to work out if magic is, would you continue to go down the magic route, or would you just go, actually, it's a lot easier to not do all of the tricks and carry everything around. Let's just go down the theatre route.
It's not the carrying everything around, because we carry a lot. So our science show, which is just science stuff, there's no magic tricks in it. That is a full van and takes 4 hours to set up and is an absolute nightmare.
Yeah.
The difference is what we're finding both about the science and about the Musketeers is it's really, really nice to do a show where
you're not deceiving the audience.
The feedback you're getting is not dependent on, it's much easier to convey what you're trying to convey because you're not hiding anything.
Yeah.
Magic is odd. Magic is really, really odd because you're constantly doing that duck, you know, paddling, trying to look serene. And everything that's complicated and hard, you're trying to hide, and things can go wrong, and things might not go wrong. But also, ultimately, you are doing stuff that, with the best will in the world, there is no trick out there that will definitely fool everyone who watches it.
Yeah.
And you never know how many people are going to be in your audience who may or may not be fooled by what they are watching.
Yeah.
In a kid's show, it's easier. We do family magic shows, and that's easier because kids will tell you, as I'm sure you're aware, whether or not
kids will tell you if something didn't work.
If something doesn't work. And so you're able to piece together more easily the version of the show where it's got the highest chance of getting the best reaction.
Well, I remember when we first started doing the science show, which was the first show we had with no magic in it. You know, it's just us doing science and talking about science. And
there's a bit more to it than that.
There's a bit more to it than that. It's still more than West. It's still
isn't
silly.
Isn't science lovely?
It's still more than West. There's still jokes. There's still us being silly and over the top and stuff, but there's no magic in it. And I remember the first time we did it going, I feel like we're not doing anything.
Yeah, we felt like we're cheating.
I feel like this is cheap. I'm just standing and talking and people are listening.
Yeah, it's weird.
And it's that, and actually after a while, after going, I feel like I'm doing anything, now you go, God, this is really nice. It feels like there's very little work on stage. Because I'm not going, oh, do that, load that, hope that. I'm just going, yeah, what we do, like, what we do Musketeers, even though there's a lot of work in the show and it's very hot, we're doing very quick costume changes.
I mean, I feel like I've done a lot of work at the end of the show, I'll be honest. I'm quite tired. But...
Yeah, very quick costume changes, lots of fights, that's the thing. But it's still, I think, going like, there's a lovely honesty with it of just going, yeah, we're here doing a fun thing and you're enjoying it. And no one in the audience is sitting there going, I reckon they've arranged these fights in advance. I was like, yeah, of course we have.
Yeah.
And honestly,
I reckon one of them rings has got a hole in it. Okay, fine.
Yeah, of course. And genuinely, I think if it were the rest of my career just doing magic or the rest of my career not doing magic, I'd take the not doing magic because there is so much more to do with that.
Mm.
Like,
obviously, we've done a lot of magic.
We've done so many
shows. If you asked me that same question 5 years ago, I might not have the same answer. Quite apart from the fact that we hadn't done really any magic shows, but we hadn't. 5 years ago, we'd only just started exploring what we could do with kids' work. We'd only just started doing the Christmas show, and so we still
had lots of things we wanted
still
to
tinkering
do.
With. We were still faffing with it, but we've got an idea for another evening magic show in our heads, and it's been there since 2014,
and it'll probably stay there for a good few years. Yeah, but and it's not that we don't like doing magic, but yeah, we've done tons of magic shows over the year, and now we're like, well,
we've also done pretty much every type of magic that we can imagine. That, you know, we've done Grand Illusion, we've done close up card tricks of 20 people around a table in a show, we've done mind reading, we've done cups and balls variants, we've done I can't think of a genre of magic that we haven't done.
Well, definitely not a genre of like ticketed magic.
Yeah.
The kind of thing you can sell tickets to.
Never done any Rubik's Cube magic.
We've never done any Rubik's Cube magic. I said things you can sell tickets to. No, but yeah, and like, whereas...
We'd like Rubik's Cube magic. We remember we were doing MagiFest in Columbus, Ohio in 2014 when Stephen Brundage was just a kid.
It was just some guy.
Just some kid.
Stephen Brundage. And he came out to show us some stuff. And we were
both like, what?
Oh!
I don't understand.
Because at that point,
how does this work?
Everyone
threw it behind your back, and then it was a. I don't get it, mate.
Yeah,
what's going on?
Especially because everyone.
Sorry,
we've
got to go and do a show.
Everyone had seen that thing where you miss spot one and solve it by throwing it and catching it very particularly and not on one side.
Yeah.
And he's there going no, and we're like,
don't get it.
But like, yeah, and it's the thing. I think right now for us, the thing that magicians know Morgan and West for is the amount of thought we put into our work, the methods we do, the fact we do code, the fact we do this and then. But the things that our ticket-buying audiences know us for are fun, silly, family-friendly shows.
Yeah.
And actually, you can come to a bunch of magic shows and be like, and you can know a Morgan and West magic show when you see it, and then you can come and see our science show. And I think a lot of our audiences are going, I don't know what this is going to be like. And when they leave, they go,
oh, it's the same.
It's the same.
Same thing.
It's not magic, it's science, but it's definitely a Morgan and West show.
And the Musketeers is the same thing.
It's not science, it's not magic, it's a play, but it's definitely a Morgan and West show. And we're at that stage now, I think, where... both in terms of our position in the industry as in the theatre industry and being known by venues and things like that, and among audiences, both at those venues and our own personal audience on social media or whatever, we are known by non-magicians as just people who make good family-friendly stuff.
I think that's because you've spent so long working on your brand. And I think one thing that we have to bring up when I'm talking to Morgan and West is, you know, you've mastered the art of characterization, and you know your characters inside out and back to front, and you have this recognizable brand, not just to magicians, but also to people all over the UK. They know who you are and they know what to expect when they come to your shows. Do you have any advice on creating that brand, or creating that persona that you use, which is very, I remember, and do you ever find that people have like tried to rip you off? Because I remember
you're about to mention a phone call that you made to us.
A phone call to you guys. I was watching David Penn many, many years ago at the Britain's Got Talent final. Britain Does Variety.
Britain Does Variety. That's what we knock off station.
We were doing a gig in Hebden Bridge at the time. We were touring in Hebden Bridge, and we were sat in the dressing room, and I got a phone call, and it was you. And you said to us, "Hello, I'm stood at just been watching David doing stuff with Britain Does Variety, and there's an act here called the Marvelous Time Travelers. And I've had a word with them. And what did you say? And because Piff the Magic Dragon was there as well, wasn't it?
Piff was there. Piff
also, when they came off stage, Piff said to them, "Have you ever heard of Morgan and West?" And apparently they said, "You're the second person that said that to us today." And Piff went, "I won't be the last."
And your phone call was the thing that spurred us to go and buy the domain names timetravelingmagicians.com and .co.uk that very afternoon.
Yeah. we later discovered that those guys had invited us to lecture at their university magic club. We hadn't been able to do it because we had a gig. It was like, they knew who we were.
They knew what was going on.
They just wholesale took our act. Magic, I think, can be a bit weird about, like, crediting you can't do that because it's so-and-so's, you can't do that because it's so-and-so's. Or if, like, people saying, like, if you're going to do that on stage, you should really say on stage that it's not your trick. I was like, that's ridiculous. That is a ridiculous... To a paying audience, it's ridiculous to go, by the way, Dye Vernon wrote that? But ridiculous. But there is, in the world of performance, you take ideas from lots of places and lots of things. You go,
creativity is just how well you can hide your sources.
Exactly.
You know? And but also mixing them. That's the thing, is that creativity is not going, I'll have that. Creativity is going, oh, I like that. I don't like that bit. I like that bit. Oh, they do a cool thing. I've seen that and I don't like that. So, here you go.
And the reason we're not worried about people ripping us off is that
if they're better than us, then great.
Fair play to you.
We need to do better.
Because we've done a lot of work on being Morgan and West. And if you can read one book and go out and do our show better than we can do it, fair play to you. You clearly have done the work.
You can have it.
Whereas if you go out and do our show worse than we do it, and often people, when they copy our magicians, will miss the integral thing that makes them great and will just copy the things they say. Like, look at the number of magicians that missed everything that made Darren great and just copied going, say, ace, 2, 3, 4, 5 in your head. Like,
or the multiplying bottles that Tommy Cooper did, the Ken Brook routine.
Yeah.
The people who will do that verbatim, word for word, and won't really think about, well, what's the thing that they're bringing to it?
Yeah, because Tommy Cooper was a buffoonish, foolish, clownish character. So it makes sense to do a routine that goes completely wrong. Whereas if you're a magician who is like really suave and cool and in control, if you're Lance Burton, why are you doing a trick that comedically goes wrong? It's a really weird thing to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like, we're not worried about people ripping us off because we are an ever-changing act in terms of, obviously we have a shtick and we have a thing, but even now, like, most of our shows at the moment don't mention time travel at all because we don't need to. And our current show is set in the 17th century, so we're wearing 17th century aesthetics, not 19th century aesthetics.
Yeah.
But the point is that we have this kind of like oldie worldy timeless feel, and the characters are very well formed, but we are not at all worried about people ripping us off, because it's like, yeah, good luck to you.
In terms of advice for finding these things and branding wise, it took us ages to find anything, and we change it every now and again, and it doesn't, you know, we had a very good friend of ours, Liam, who was a graphic designer who did a lot of work for us in the beginning. And
I think the thing we say is basically, obviously it evolves over time. Our act and our look and everything has evolved over time.
Yeah, when we used to first write scripts, we'd write one script and divvy the lines up between us. Now we know how we both, and Morgan and West are very, very different. Early shows, they're the same person.
Same voice.
You hear the same voice.
Whereas now we have two characters and we write jokes for those individual characters. But when you're coming up with a character like that, and it, from a branding point of view, you want to be different to everyone else.
Yeah.
And honestly, so it's hard to be different in a subtle way.
Yeah, it's got to be a big difference.
It's got to be a big difference. Full Victoriana garb and the whole set and everything, big difference. Grumpy magic dragon, big difference. Brightly coloured waistcoat, small difference. You know, or if your shtick is like, oh no, I'm different because I'm the card guy. They're all the card guy. You know, if your thing is like, oh no, but my thing is that actually I don't do magic. I'm a sleight of hand artist and a gambler. No, everyone does that. You need to do a thing where if someone described your act without naming you, everyone will go, I know exactly who you're talking about.
And it needs to stand out specifically in your marketplace as well. Yeah. You need to identify where you're trying to sell yourself and look at everyone else in that area and then sidestep them.
Yeah.
It's like, but that's the same for everything, isn't it? That's the same for every sort of growth business model is if you offer the same as everyone else offers, you ain't gonna get anywhere with it.
And
unless you are staggeringly better than them.
Oh yeah. If you are incredible at what you do, fine. Look like everyone else, but just be that much better.
And make sure everyone knows that you're
better. But most people can't judge good like the difference between fine and great magic just to look at a 5-second clip. So
most people can't judge the difference between a fine and great sandwich. It's the same thing.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, what's the difference between a Tesco meal deal sandwich and one from Pret? You know, Pret's got nicer marketing and branding and you kind of feel a bit nicer going into a Pret than you do buying a Tesco meal deal.
Yeah. But it's like, if you're going to do this stuff for branding purposes, be different and be visibly different. Like, and is it Lee something that goes the purple magician? What's his
Lee,
name?
Lee Warren.
Lee Warren, yes,
there you go.
Now, strange choice because it doesn't tell you anything about the act. But if everything you wear is purple and all your props are purple and all your stuff's purple and people turn up to a show and it's purple.
And you bang into Google purple magician.
You're going to find Lee Warren, you know. And it's a thing of like, and just from a purely business branding sense, fair play. Like, that works.
Yeah.
I'm the purple magician. You come to my show, everything's purple. You go, yep, we're in the right place.
Yeah.
Someone says, you see a magician the other day? Yeah, who was it? He's the purple guy. Purple guy, found him. Yes, that's the exact guy. I was chatting to someone the other day who was getting a magician for their wedding. And I was like, oh, great. What's their name? And they'd like just been talking to them 2 days before. Couldn't tell me the name.
Yeah.
And was like, what's it look like? Bloke.
It's probably
so. Dark hair. Card tricks. And I had to, in the end, I ended up Googling like magician Gloucestershire and going through the list of, I think his name's Richard, like, and going through the list of people. And I was like, if you get work, that's fine. But if you want to really stand out and you want to do, especially the kind of work like kind of cruise ship work or TV work or stage work, the kind of thing where there's lots of people that want to do it and there aren't a huge number of performing opportunities.
So look at Tom Crosby, where he's found his character in The Performing Nerd.
Great.
Very specific yellow waistcoat and the tie and everything like that. And in the last 5 years, it's gone from Tom Crosby to The Performing Nerd. It's just like, yeah, it's that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people now say to us, do you know The Performing Nerd?
Yeah.
Not, do you know Tom Crosby?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's such a strong image and such a strong brand that, and you know what the show is, and it's very, very clear. That's a thing. Whereas I think, yeah, a lot of people have been like, oh, my character's cool guy.
I completely and totally agree with everything you're saying 100%. But explain Young and Strange then. Because they don't look that different. And they're doing illusions like everyone else does. They're putting comedy into it. And now, don't get me wrong, I am a huge Young and Strange fan. I think that they're amazing.
So one, double act, not many of them about. Two, top of their game. Like that, you will not find a better double act comedy magic, like doing that scale of stuff.
Yeah.
You will not find one. They've worked at doing that act again and again and again and again, from the stuff when they were touring themselves to Champions of Magic to, you know, the Wonderment, is it called?
For now,
yes. on the West End coming up and so on and so forth. You know, blah blah blah. And so they are very much top of their game.
But also, and I mean this with all love to Rich and Sam, Young and Strange are not super memorable on like posters and stuff. They're memorable because of the quality of their work. When we went to see Champions of Magic, we walked out of their show. We walked out of the show and I was like, I kind of got the feeling that I'm not sure the audience would remember their names. They'd remember them.
Remember them.
Because of their material. But Like,
and they may, and it, you know, Young and Strange, it's enough of a slightly odd one.
It's enough of a, but I think really, Sam and Rich have made a success of themselves by doing a bunch of shows, doing a bunch of Edinburgh shows, having a bunch of material in the bank, getting a chance in a show like Champions of Magic,
and making it their own,
and just going, all right, we are going to steal that show every night, and they do.
Yeah.
Like, every time I see Young and Strange and sort of do some sort of mixed bill thing, they absolutely steal it from everyone.
So we did some work with them a couple of years ago. They were teaching us Box Stab because we wanted to do sort of something to do with it with the science show. And we were saying to them then, we just really want to see their show again. We want to see just an hour and a half of them.
And it's the thing of going, and what that's a case of, I don't think Young and Strange have a strong brand, but they've had an opportunity in Champions of Magic, and they've absolutely made the most of it because of years of work that's come before it.
And they are a niche. That they are...
Two blokes doing comedy illusions is not a crowded marketplace.
No, it's rare that you get two people doing illusions that aren't magician and assistant.
Yep.
And they are equal. They are double act doing it.
And they can work for kids. Their stuff isn't blue.
Yeah.
Like, they have a huge, vast number of illusions and stuff behind them. They're really funny.
Really funny.
Like, in the same way, and you know, and I mean this as a compliment, it is, David Williamson doesn't have a strong brand.
No.
Don't need it. It's David Williamson.
For a while, his brand was that fella who did Rocky Raccoon.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. Like, that's...
In the same, like, so we were...
Or that fella that the kid got the better of on TV because the clip does the rounds every now and again. You know?
We did a gig a few years back, and one of the techs there used to work on the Disney boats, which obviously Williamson does sometimes on the cruises. And she was like, oh, do you know Magic Dave? So I was like, didn't even know his surname. Doesn't need it. He's that good. Like, and get the work from quality. But the great thing about having an incredibly strong brand is that you don't need to be that good. You need to be good, but you don't need to be better than everyone else.
There comes a point when if you're not good, it won't get you any further.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you can't just get away with a cool look. Because if you're rubbish, you're rubbish. But like, the reason we got on that first Penn & Teller show was not that our trip was amazing. The reason we got on that first Penn & Teller show was that we looked cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, the reason like people are interested in Salaya is because we look cool. And a lot of time the reason people come to see our shows is not because they've heard anything about us in terms of quality. We just look cool.
We look different. We look interesting.
Like, when we were at the Edinburgh Fringe and we used to fly for hours every day, we were in costume and we looked cool. And people go, this is a thing I like. Or I like the look of, so I'll go and see that.
Well, I'm going to wrap this up in a minute, but I want to ask you a question, the same question that I asked Richard Young when I interviewed him, which is, do you ever worry? I mean, the brand that you've built is Morgan & West.
Yeah.
It would be very weird to have just tonight only Morgan. It just wouldn't work. Do you ever worry that your future as performers is tied into each other? And what I mean by that is, what happens if one of you decides one day, you know what, I'm done, that's it, I'm done, look, you can have everything, Morgan & West is finished as far as I'm concerned.
So we've got sort of half joking, half genuine contingencies about all this. We have open conversations about, so for a start, we have sort of logistical plans for if one of us falls really ill, if one of us dies, if one of us decides they just don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
And part of that is kind of keeping the conversation open and fresh. You know, it's not a checking in with each other. It's not a, are you still happy doing this? But it's knowing, trusting that if the other person was finding an aspect of what they were doing sufficiently unenjoyable that it was possibly jeopardizing the whole thing, they would talk about it.
Yeah. And part of the reason we did magic shows, then we did kids magic shows, then we did a Christmas magic show, then we did a science show, now we're in the Three Musketeers, is that we're stopping ourselves getting bored.
Yeah.
We couldn't do the same 20 minutes for a whole career. I'd just lose the
number of times I've told people the digits on their bank card, and now it just becomes a kind of like, it's 6147. Yeah, lovely. Yeah, thanks like, very much. Off we go.
And you know, it's that thing of going, like, we actively work to keep our work, the kind of our jobs exciting and fresh and that. But that said,
I mean, the two show names, obviously, the individual show names are Morgan Freeman and Way Out West.
Way Out West, yeah.
Those are the two names.
I mean, we have which is a sort of joke, but I think the kind of joke that we probably would follow through on, that if one of us were to die
it absolutely has to be followed through on.
If one of us were to die in some sort of accident or, I don't know, some illness or something, the other one will do like a last show about the fact that the other one's not there. Because there's something really interesting about the idea of a double act where one of them's gone. Mm. And like you look at the, like there's that interview on, I can't remember which chat show it is, with Ernie Wise, like 2 days after Eric Morecambe died. And there's this weird sort of stillness. It's not like awful. He's not like in things, but there's a sort of weird sort of stillness about him, which is that thing of going, oh,
this is it now.
Oh, and obviously they were slightly later in their career. But and it is that thing of like, yeah, so we have this sort of deal of like, there will be a show after one, if one of us goes, which will be about the kind of closing out of the thing. And we also had an idea years ago.
If we get to close out Morgan and West together, if we're, at some point we decide, you know what, this is done, we want to do one last show where we will do it add to as many people as we can muster.
Yeah.
Where at the end of the show, whilst people are in the show, all of the posters in the theatre get taken down, our website gets deleted.
Our social medias get deleted.
And at the end of the show, we go backstage and shave and possibly shave our heads and just walk out the door. And that's it.
And we're going to call it Morgan and West the Vanishing. At the end of the show, we vanish and we never come back.
And that's it. Done.
We vanish, we crawl out of whatever we've just dropped into, and the audience are just left there going, where did they go? And we're gone by the time they get out.
And there's no trace of it when they're leaving. That's the idea, because we think that would be fun.
That'd be a fun way to go out, wouldn't it?
Because also, you've kind of got to, if you decide that you're stopping, you've kind of got to burn your bridges a little bit to make sure that you don't get tempted back.
Yeah. Well, no, but also, theoretically, there might come a point in the future where one of us goes, you know what, I don't...
Oh, by that, I mean, so you can't just pick it up next week.
Yeah. You know? But it would make, like, but yeah, but if one of us, if he turns around to me, in a few years, well, I say next year, but we've got gigs booked in for a little while now. But turn around.
That's the other deal, is if one of us decides they don't want to do it anymore,
you've got to see out the diary.
You've got to see out the diary. And that's becoming increasingly long. at the moment, if one of us turns around and goes, actually, I don't want to do this anymore, that's fine. We're booked until the end of 2022.
But
suck it up.
Yeah, eat it for 2 years. But honestly, if he turned around to me tomorrow and said, okay, I want to see out all the gigs we've got and then I'm done, I want to, you know, move up north and start a guinea pig sanctuary, then, okay. We've done so much in our career. Like, it's not been that long a career by a lot of magic scales, but we've done a lot. And
the irony for us of the pandemic hitting was about a month prior to it, month and a half, before the news had started bubbling about this thing coming out of Wuhan, was that we had been saying, God, this is lovely, isn't it? God, we've done a lot. Yeah, and the book was just about to come out and all this. God, if it's all ended tomorrow, it'd be all right. I mean, we've done it all.
Well, honestly, and then we were saying, this was it. If we were done, I'd be fine. And I honestly think
We were. We were actually quite, once we worked out how long it was going to be, we were both quite calm about it.
Yeah.
We worked out, well, we've got this much money in the bank. We can survive for this long. If we can start again after that, great.
Right.
If we can't.
If not.
You know, if it comes to 18 months and we haven't done any gigs at all, we then have got enough money that we can spend the next 6 months looking for work.
Retraining, you know?
And working out what we want to do.
But, yeah, and it was that thing of going, like, yeah, we've achieved a lot, I think, and a lot of stuff that I'm really proud of, like shows I'm really proud of making, the book and everything, and going, if that was it, if that was our foray into showbiz, what possible regrets would we have? Like, you know? Yeah. And then we're like, and because also there are sides of our work that I don't enjoy, but like, would it be nice to be home on the weekends? Yes.
Like, we've gone from having the last 15 months where we've spent every weekend at home to all of a sudden now we don't have, I think we've got like 2 weekends between now and Christmas maybe.
Yeah.
Wow. And
obviously we both got partners and my partner's a teacher, and so
works
during term time, and then on the weekends when she's off we're working, and then on school holidays when she's off we're working. So it becomes a thing of going, yeah, like there would be a lot of upsides to not doing this anymore, and I think we'd find something else to do.
This is your way of telling me that you're leaving.
Yeah, I'm out of here. Actually, I texted Crazy, please bring this up.
Yeah
so I can break it. Yeah, like
I'm happy to help.
So he has to take it well. Yeah.
But I want to ask you one last question, which is, I know that you guys aren't planning on going anywhere anytime soon, despite what we've just talked about. I'm going to ask you the same question I've asked to everybody that I've interviewed on this channel, which is, what's next? You just spent 5 minutes talking about how much you've achieved, and you have. Your legacy is set. If you stop tomorrow, people will remember Morgan and West for a very, very long time. both magicians and non-magicians. Is there anything left on your magical bucket list? Or not even magical. Is there anything left on your theatrical bucket list that you haven't done with Morgan and West that you'd like to do? Any plans that you've got moving forward that you'd like to tick off?
I hate to be those people, but yes.
So, yeah, so we have a thing we're working on we can't talk about,
and we genuinely can't talk about it. And it's not like it's a TV show or anything like that.
It's a theatrical thing. It's just a theatre show we're working on, but we can't talk about it yet. But yeah, so that we're excited about doing, and obviously we would be a smidge disappointed if that never happened.
Yeah. But it's been 3.5 years in the waiting so far, and it's not going to happen for another 2 years, so exactly, that's fine.
Can I ask, is there magic in that show, or is there no magic?
Yes, there will. Yeah, it's not like a full magic show, but there'll be magic in it.
And it's specifically about Morgan and West as well. It's not like,
I think, weirdly for me, it's again in the idea of, we did the science show, we did a kids show, we did a musketeer show.
I would be sad if we never got to finish touring the science show, because I don't think that had enough of its time.
Yeah. I think, weirdly for me, the thing that I would be like, I would like to do that, is that I want to try and write something else. Like, I don't know what it is, but like, even if it's like for someone else, which I know is a weird thing to say, like, what's the one thing you as Morgan and West haven't achieved is doing a show for not Morgan and West.
I know what you mean.
But I think because we've spent our entire careers tied to these characters, and we love these characters, we're very fond of them, we know what they are now.
Musketeers was, in a way, a breath of fresh air, because we got to write for Peter.
Exactly. And there is a little part inside of me that's like, I'd kind of like to write a show and give it to someone else. Whether that's a play that we give to actors, or a magic show we give to the magician or something. Like, there's a little part of me that's like, I'd kind of like to create something.
The outside input on it.
Be like in the, when we do like theatrical consultancy for like, you know, magic special effects in shows.
Need to read that script.
We do need to read that script, yeah. Then you get to be part of this creative team, and then you get to sit and watch the show happen. And it's a very different feeling watching them being like, I was a tiny part of that. And like, yeah, there was a little part of me, it's like, I'd really like to write something and be able to sit in the audience and watch it happen. I wonder if part of that has come from doing Musketeers, where sometimes I'm backstage frantically getting changed while you and Peter are on stage doing lines and getting laughs and being like, that's funny. I'm part of the creative process behind that laugh.
Yeah.
But I'm literally stood backstage doing nothing.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I do think there is actually a universe in which we would quite enjoy you writing something and me directing it.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
You know, that would be...
Could that be the evolution of Morgan and West in the future? Like, you talked at the very beginning of
this interview
theatrical company, you know, would you, when you've had enough of touring, would you maybe transition into setting up a company?
Nothing's off the table.
Nothing's off the table.
You know, that's part of the journey, isn't it? Is we've been doing this now full time just under a decade, and on and off for a few years more. Changes all the time, doesn't it? Just keep bobbing along with it. And
yeah, we were going to be close-up workers, and now we're here.
We were going to have a puppet theatre company that did sketch shows, you know? Yeah. It's just like, at one point, literally at the end of the university, I bought like 10 puppets from various qualities. And it was only about 3 years ago that I finally got rid of them, because I was like, these are just...
We're never going to use these. But yeah, like...
Why have I got this orangutan? I don't need this orangutan.
we love to create more than anything else, and... I think we'll always carry on doing that, but we genuinely don't know the way in which we will do that or what that will look like, because we genuinely don't know. A couple of years ago, a few years back, before we were wandering around at a magic convention in Ohio, we would never have dreamed of doing a show with a third person in it. And then suddenly the idea popped into our head, and then a pandemic happened, and then Musketeers is here.
Yeah.
Like, it's that thing of, yeah, like, I'm sure we'll always keep creating stuff, but I think there might be a time at which, yeah, we sort of not hang up our boots forever, but where we go, you know what, we might take a year off to just write a thing and produce it and give it to someone else to tour.
Yeah, I've never understood that either, because I've never hung up a pair of boots.
No.
You always put them...
Wellies, though. You hang up your wellies, don't you, so they don't get spiders in. You know, like one of them... But, you know, or fine. But, you know, we may not ever fully hang up, but we don't hang up our shirts.
No, we
don't. Hang up our top hats. But
they're in a bag in the front of the van at the moment, actually. Yeah.
But
the shirts, that is not a topic.
But I think there will be a point at which we start to
it's a change, isn't it?
Every time change our working, change the kind of work we do, and move off of the stage a bit in terms of the creativity.
Mm. And do you ever still take private bookings, or is it now all?
Yeah,
I mean, we get inquiries.
The problem is basically
we do that stand. You do that thing, don't you, where you look at it and you go, "Is this something I actually want to do? If it's something that I would quite enjoy doing, I'll quote a reasonable price. If it's something I don't want to do,
I'll quote an unreasonable price.
And if they decide to pay that unreasonable price, you think,
"I'm not doing it for an unreasonable price.
Should have made it more unreasonable."
genuinely. Because theatre books up, not at the moment, but theatre generally books up a long way in advance. Usually when someone books us, we're already busy. And even if we're not busy, if there's a chance we could become busy, then we need to quote a fee that is more than we would get. Like a if someone books us on a Saturday night, and even if it's like for a wedding 2 years from now, so we're not booked, we need to charge them more than we would earn doing a theatre show on that day. Which is not a bad, like, you know, doing a packed out kids show or two kid shows in a day on a Saturday in a 500 seat theatre is a good payday. So I'm not going to charge someone £400 for a wedding and block out that day. Like, and even then when it comes to like corporate work and stuff, we're usually booked up because corporate work books short notice, the kind of work we get. And I don't like doing it. So we'll only go out for silly money. So we tend not to get those bookings. So yeah, theoretically, yeah, we do private work, but I can't remember the last private gig we did.
No. Side business school.
Yeah.
Side business.
Yeah, that Christmas 2019. Christmas party sort of thing. But
there you go.
But yeah, other than that, yeah, very rare.
Close up magic at the tables of a Christmas party, and it was fine. Happened.
Fine. Cool. Well, look, we're going to wrap all this up now, but can you just tell us a little bit about The Musketeers for people that are watching this that want to come out and watch it? Where is it touring? Where can they find the dates? And tell us a little bit about the show.
morganandwest.co.uk/live-dates, or you can just go to morganandwest.co.uk and click on
the live dates page. Dates
button. That's probably easier. It's going to be touring all over England. I don't think we're doing any Scottish or Welsh dates.
Not this year.
Going all over the place. I'm updating the website later this afternoon, actually, with a few new ones that have just come in.
It's a big, silly outdoor, mostly. Sometimes it's in a tent, but in a big circus tent. But generally, it's a big, fun, silly, outdoor, family-friendly show. There's sword fights and silliness and us and Peter Clifford. Just having a good time and mucking about.
It is complete nonsense.
Yeah.
Like, if you are hardcore fans of the original novel, then this may not be...
It isn't entirely accurate to the book.
Yeah. But I don't know anyone who's actually read the book.
No.
Like, we've not read the book. No. So that's the thing.
But it is a big, fun, silly show. And we really enjoyed doing it.
Yeah.
And it is family friendly as well.
Oh, yeah.
Like all our stuff, totally
it's,
family
it's,
friendly.
What we tend to sort of talk about is it's our Simpsons humor model, where if you're 5 or 6, there's jokes for you. If you're a teenager, there's jokes for you. If you're an adult, there's jokes for you. If you're a grandparent, there's jokes for you.
Yeah.
And you know, you engage on the level that you want to engage with it, one or more of those.
Yeah.
There's something for everyone in it, quite genuinely. But that's the way we'd like to write stuff.
Yeah.
Perfect. Absolutely brilliant. Guys, this has been a real pleasure. Seriously, thank you so much. We've just talked about how big you are. So the fact that you found time to do this, it means a lot. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. We're going to go and sew some stuff for Three Musketeers that needs fixing. So
that's always fun. Although you told me that it's Robert that does all the sewing.
He does all the costume making. He taught me how to use a sewing machine for straight lines a couple of weeks ago.
So we've got some pennants that need fixing that I'm willing to let Reese do.
Yeah.
So you've skilled up in the pandemic as well. It's good.
I now know how to use a sewing machine with supervision.
Yeah.
So that's...
And what a great way to end the interview. Amazing. Anybody watching this, guys, leave a comment down below. I'm sure that Morgan and West will see it. And outside of that, guys, one more time, I said at the beginning of the interview, I mean every word I say, I'm a massive Morgan and West fanboy. Whether you continue to tour or do magic or no magic, whatever it is, I'm always going to be there supporting you. So, guys, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Guys, make sure that you leave a comment down below, like the video, subscribe to the channel, and I will be back again tomorrow with another video. Thanks very much for watching. My name's Craig.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic.
Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered.
Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic podcast.